Amiga, te tengo tremendo cuento.
If you switch to AT&T, you can get $300 in credits when you buy a Samsung Galaxy S6 on AT&T Next and trade in a smartphone.
Wow. Why are you whispering so much? What are you talking about?
Great news. Switch to AT&T and get $300 in credits.
What?
Are you serious? Norma, did you hear? $300 in credits when you switch to AT&T.
Switch to AT&T and get $300 in credits when you buy a Samsung Galaxy S6 on AT&T Next and trade in a smartphone. AT&T, mobilizing your world. Limited time offers. Requires port-in eligible service and trade-in. Get $100 bill credit applied within 90 days and $200 trade-in credit, which may be a promotion card. Fees, other charges, and restrictions apply. See store or att.com/summerbuyback for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Warren Whitlock Show, your source for what works, what's new, and what's cool in the world of business, marketing, and social media. Now, here's your host, Warren Whitlock.
Hello, welcome to the show, and here's another great interview we have today. We're going to be talking to Rand Brenner about what our intellectual property is worth. Rand has been, he's currently president and CEO of Licensing Consulting Group and a founder of Licensing for Profits. And he's got 25 years experience of some very big brands. So I'm looking forward to hearing about what he's learned and how that can help any author or content creator today. Welcome to the show, Rand.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being here. And it's always great to get a chance to come out and share with folks about the exciting world of intellectual property and licensing. So thanks for having me on, Warren.
Okay. I don't hear attorneys or people talking about legal things calling it exciting very often. So, but
it's interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, looking at some of the stuff you've done. Yeah.
You actually brought up something very interesting, and we can touch on this a little more. But you know, when you say lawyers look at it, the legal side is what most people, you know, think about, and it is kind of, you know, it's critical and it's imperative, yet that's such a small part of it. And that's where the fun is the other part, the money-making side, which is really what I focus on.
Well, that sounds great. You know, I did hear a story recently of somebody working on getting a voice in the video game. And it was, you know, a 60-page contract, and that's usually what I think of when I think of things like this. And the poor developer couldn't even understand what he was signing, and all he wanted was, you know, pay somebody $1,000 for use of their voice. But let's get back to intellectual. Tell me something about how you got started in this and how it's changed in 25 years.
Oh, good story. It's like everything else. This is one of those things that I kind of fell into. And my background really is I got my education and I got out of college with a advertising degree, and I got into that field, but it really wasn't a fit for me. And because kind of looking around at that time on wanting to do something, and this was in the 80s. And wound up getting a phone call from somebody that I used to work with in advertising, who was now at a company that was at that time a division of Warner Brothers called Licensing Corporations of America, and said, you know, would you be interested in coming over and joining us and licensing in the licensing division? And I'm like, okay, sure, but you know, what is licensing? I had never heard of it. I was not familiar with it. So I went over there, and long story short, I was hired on. And basically what was happening at the time is the studio was just getting organized to do some kind of merchandise program around then the first Batman movie. That was the Nicholson Keaton movie that was coming out, but they had no idea what to do. And it was kind of funny because really the licensing division was kind of charged with going out and doing something to make money for this movie because the studio didn't think it was going to make any money. It got a very cool reception with retailers and everybody because, you know, they didn't think that comic book characters had any life. So they figured, well, okay, let's go out and see if we could do something around products. And so literally the way I got into this business is I was handed a phone and said, go see if you can find somebody who, you know, wants to get rights to this and make some product around it. And it was kind of a learn as I go kind of situations. And then, of course, you know, as you fast forward from that point on, you see that the industry has really boomed. And it was many people don't realize that at that time, especially for the studios, they weren't involved in merchandise. There was very little of it going on. And you can see that. I mean, if you go way back to the Star Wars films, which Fox released, they never took the merchandise rights. And that ultimately led Lucas to becoming as successful as he was and creating a multi-billion-dollar company because he had all the merchandise rights to the movies, to the whole franchise. And that ultimately is what became the big value. And so now you see a lot of movies and TV shows today now, you know, really are synchronized, if you will, with merchandise because that's really where the money is. The back end money is on selling the products and the services and the promotions and the live events and everything else that goes on with it.
So when somebody has an idea for the next cartoon character or, you know, story or whatever, that's their intellectual property. They can license it and either make a deal with the big publisher or studio or retain that for themselves. But once you have this license, are you actually out there making toys? Tell us about exactly what you do when you're a license holder.
It's basically is what you're doing is you're renting the rights to somebody else's intellectual property. That's effectively what you are when you're a what's called a licensee. Okay, it's kind of like the leasee in property, but you're effectively renting the rights, and you get certain rights depending on what it is. So in the example of toys, if you're a toy company, typically what was happening in the situation of a movie or a TV show, you were going in and you were negotiating to get the rights to produce, you know, some assortment of toys based on the movie or the TV show. In the case of, let's say, Batman, it was, you know, Batman, Robin, the Batmobile, whatever the heck it was. And basically, what you're doing is you're taking that license, using those images and the trademarks and everything else, and you're creating products around it, and you're going to retail and you're selling, you know, those products. And this is even for services too, by the way. I mean, it's not only products at retail. And basically, you're taking advantage of the fact that this IP, this intellectual property, this movie, is widely known. Obviously, if it's released on movie screens throughout the United States and around the world, a lot of people are going to be familiar with it, know about it, and that leads to people who are always, you know, wanting to buy products based on it. And so for a lot of companies, interestingly enough, when I was on the studio side, especially in those early days, there were a lot of small companies, and I'm talking about you'd consider them mom and pop entrepreneurs, garage entrepreneurs, who really they understood what they could do with movie intellectual property, and they didn't have big companies and manufacturing plants and all that sort of stuff. They just knew that if they could come in and get some rights to this movie, then they could go and you know, subcontract the manufacturing and hire a distributor and get their products out, that they could potentially make a lot of money. And that's, in fact, what happened is that I'd say probably 70-80% of the initial companies that came into the Batman license, and this same holds true for Power Rangers, by the way, were small companies who were willing to take a risk. Because I can tell you, many of the large corporations, the toy companies, and the retail stores, they shunned it. They turned their back. They said, no way, this is not something that people are going to want to buy. And so a lot of those small companies came in and for very small amounts of money, they got these rights, and they went out and they took a risk. And, of course, the risk paid off in this case, and many of them grew very large companies very quickly. And you know, a lot of them became very wealthy simply because they understood this idea, if I could get the rights to this intellectual property, I could do something with it. And you see that,
right,
that repeat itself over and over again, and obviously entertainment's a very big part of it. But there's other places that have grown, you know, sports is another example, whether it's major league teams or motorsports or whatever it is, that's grown a lot. Car racing, whether it's Formula or NASCAR, that's grown a lot. I mean, in the 80s, it wasn't, licensing was really not as prevalent as it is today from an entertainment side because nobody really understood it. And then suddenly, as you got into the late 80s and 90s, people began to recognize the market shifted. Suddenly, this whole idea of merchandise became really a money driver. And then as you got toward the latter 90s and into you know, 2000 and beyond, it really became mature and suddenly, you know, morphed into this multi-billion-dollar business that really generates all these products and services. And so you've seen this close marriage now, if you will, between licensing entertainment, licensing in video games, licensing in entertainment, licensing in live theater, licensing in books, TV shows. In sporting events, you see it everywhere. And by the way, it's growing around the world. It's growing very, very quickly because many countries who were not very active or proactive in either developing or protecting intellectual property rights have really come 360 and are now very aggressive since the late 90s in really developing the infrastructure and enforcing and standardizing their intellectual property laws to conform with, you know, international standards that were developed between the United States and, you know, predominantly Western Europe. And the result is now you're seeing a big boom in the world of intellectual property because now you've got a worldwide market that's suddenly come alive and recognized, you know, the wealth creating potential that is there in intellectual property, and that opens up opportunities, you know, for everybody, even in a larger context, because today you could do licensing around the world and you never have to leave home. I mean, you can use Skype and email, because the nice thing about intellectual property is it travels.
So I hear a lot of stories about that. Well, first of all, it's just, you know, mind-boggling when you start thinking about every time I've got somebody with a, you know, a logo on a shirt that there's some deal behind that where a licensing fee was paid. I had a neighbor back when I rented an industrial complex many years ago, made dashboard covers, and he stuck he handmade these things, staff of two or three or four. And, you know, he'd put them in an RV, go out to shows and sell them. And when somebody says, I want one with a, you know, GM logo on it or whatever, he'd go get the license. And the fees he was paying seemed to be quite high at the time. And he showed me the math. He was selling so many more because of the license, literally on all sorts of things. But in the online era, what I keep hearing about on this topic is, like, somebody's a fan and they start writing about their favorite TV show and putting, you know, clips or stills from the show, talking about, or maybe even use the name in a domain name, and then they get cease and desist letters. And, you know, that goes on as to, you know, should fan fiction be allowed? Does it help the brand or hurt the brand and things like that? Are there opportunities for somebody who is running a small fan site or doing something like that to actually get properly licensed and turn it into merchandise and make some money off of it?
Yeah, there most definitely is. I mean, fans are ultimately consumers of all licensed merchandise, and I think that you know, if one opportunity you're looking for is to build a fan site, there's many that have been very successful in creating a site that is selling merchandise, is offering inside information about the movies or the TV shows and their licensing content, either from the producers or the studios, and they're selling authorized merchandise, and really they're creating a hub, if you will, where people can go who want to consume all these different parts of the intellectual property. Typically where you run into some of the legal issues is if you decide to put up a fan site and grab all this content, copyrighted material, and, you know, decide to start making a few products of your own and selling them without any licensing. agreements in place, that's where you're going to run into a problem. But I think that that's a perfect example of opportunities that exist for anybody, is using the online medium or the online channel to be able to actually get a piece of these you know, big entertainment content. It's ideal, actually. The internet's a licensing dream, is what it is.
So, and of course, my experience was that, you know, this guy who just seemed to be a guy that was more or less living in his RV. well, that's because we always saw him going off to where he sold his stuff. And, you know, and when he told me he was paying mid five figures for a license, I just thought, wow, it's like, how does someone get started with that? This little guy who I thought was probably making a couple thousand dollars a weekend. He wasn't. He was doing much better than I first thought. But, you know, could a blogger actually get a license for something that was in an affordable kind of a price where they could just go try this?
Well, I think, you know, as I say, you can always negotiate an affordable deal on just about anything. It depends on what it is that you want to do. And, you know, I look at it.
Or is it percentages, or how do you pay? You give us an example, not exact numbers, at least some ballpark.
Yeah, typically, I mean, you would see the deals that are done. You know, I've done deals that anywhere that are what are called guarantees of $5,000. You know, meaning that you're going to guarantee to pay them $5,000 and a 10% royalty, meaning that you'll pay 10% of sales of everything you sell, all the way up to hundreds of thousands and even millions of dollars in guarantees. And I throw these terms around and I'll explain them. Guarantee is typically a term that's found in licensing agreements that says that I, the renter or the licensee of your intellectual property, you know, I'm going to make a financial commitment to you, and I'm going to guarantee to pay you X amount over the 2 or 3 years that I'm renting your property. And so that's called the guarantee. And that's something that I, as the property owner, you know, I want to make money with my IP. So I want to make sure that if somebody is going to get the rights, I need some kind of financial guarantee so that I know at the minimum it's going to be worth my while to give that licensee the rights to go out and do something with the IP. So typically it's called a guarantee. And then there's a royalty rate, which is usually done as a percentage. Sometimes it's a fixed fee or a fixed amount, but it's usually a percentage of whatever is sold. And then the definition of sales is usually, you know, if you're selling wholesale, then it's usually at wholesale. If you're selling at direct retail, then it's at retail. But you agree to pay a percentage of that as a royalty to the IP owner. And that's basically how the process works to get paid. And then, you know, it's reported quarterly or whatever it is. And I've worked with deals where I've had companies come in and, you know, they start off small with one or two items. And so the deal starts off small with $5,000 or $10,000 commitment. And then they come back and they add more products. And so the contract grows. And, of course, I've had the opposite. There's a lot of times I've worked with companies and clients that say, oh, we're going to go in and get this huge, big category of products. And I always suggest that, you know, don't necessarily go there unless you're prepared to pay big money, because obviously the more you ask for, the more the IP owner is gonna want. So, you know, if you're new to the process, and let's say that you're a company and you're thinking, I'd like to use licensing to ramp up and, you know, expand my business, find something that makes sense for you, that matches your products or your services, or it's a market, or you've got the capabilities that, you know, you've got the manufacturing and distribution that makes sense for it. Go in there, find out what it is, and you know, always consider starting small. Get your feet wet. Make sure you are comfortable with it, because you can always go back and ask for more. And that way, it doesn't put you in a position of having to spend a lot of money up front before you get a chance to really kind of test the waters, so to speak.
Yeah, and so if you're going to get into this and making a commitment of several thousand dollars over a 3 year period, you're not depositing that to start out with. That's very affordable.
Yeah, not necessarily. Anyway. I mean, we could get into, there's all sorts of ways of doing deals, a front-loaded, back-loaded. These are all terms that are thrown around. But depending on what the deal is, typically, you know, you want to minimize, you know, if I'm getting the license from you, then I'm going to, and you say, well, Rand, I want you know, a lot of money. I want $1 million. And I say, well, I can't afford to give you $1 million up front. I think that that your IP is worth $1 million over the 3 years that we're going to do the deal. But I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you, you know, $10,000 now upon signing. And then let's, you know, put the payments for $1 million over the 3 years so that I get an opportunity to get the products into the market and start to sell it. And then I can start to pay you the financial commitment, the guarantee, but I'll be able to do it because I have sales that are happening. And so, you know, as the sales come in, I'm able to pay you. So that's, you know, typically how a deal is negotiated, trying to find a good balance between what the financial commitment is and how the payments are made. Now, in some cases, you may find some licensors, which, like, for instance, the studios, I have a lot of people ask me questions about, well, if I go to studio to get a movie or a TV deal, I mean, depending on who you are and depending on how popular the movie or the TV show is, they could be in a position that says, no, you got to pay us all the money up front. And that's just
right.
The price you're going to have to pay because they happen to have a very popular intellectual property. But there's situations where that's not always going to be the case, and there's lots and lots of opportunity out there to get IP for very low cost. So, you know, as you think about doing this licensing, it's just a question, you know, it's like anything else. You know, do you start off with your, you know, your Ford truck, or do you go right for the Maserati or the Ferrari?
Well, let's go ahead and flip this around, because I know you know, a lot of my experience, what I've done has been like I'm creating content, and
right.
And you know, so I mean, this interview is now content.
Okay.
It doesn't have something to license that I can see. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but then if I'm writing about my expertise, business books, things like that, are there any opportunities there?
There's a lot of opportunities. Actually, you bring up a good point with expertise. Anything that you do that you become an expert in, that you've created a system, a process, a device, a way of doing it, you've done it over and over again, you've helped your clients make money, you've helped them improve their productivity, you've seen their profits grow, you make their businesses run better, and it goes on and on. I mean, that's your IP. Oftentimes you may not look at it, but that's your intellectual property, and you've probably written, you know, reports, recommendations, you may have even put special reports together that you've given clients. Well, all of that is your intellectual property. And so you've got all this great content. And the idea is basically to step away from the content and realize this is intellectual property. And as an intellectual property, where else can I go with it? Does it necessarily have to be just a book? And the answer is no, that's not the case. I'll give you some examples. You know, when you look at we were talking about this earlier, when you look at what's going on in movies and TV shows today, we're going through a cycle where all these big movies and TV shows, they're all coming out of books. Books that were written, you know, sci-fis, fantasies is primarily what they are, kids' books. When you look at the Harry Potter series, you look at Twilight, you've got Ender's Game, which is a big new movie coming out, all based on books, is these books are which have content, which you've written, are IP that can be developed into other formats. Now, I use, you know, movies and TV shows as an example because there then, of course, they expand out into products. But taking it back to your idea of being an expertise, the same thing holds true. If you take that content and you think about where can I go with it, you know, you've got different forms that you could license it out to. You may be good at putting it in that written form, but maybe you don't have the distribution or the time to be able to put it into, you know, online downloadable formats such as digital products or DVDs or CDs or whatever it is. You could license those rights out. Also, too, converting them into video format and licensing to somebody else who transforms them into videos. I mean, you know, oftentimes, here's an example, is you may have written, you know, a book on productivity or leadership or something, but it's only in a book form. Somebody will come along and say, wait a minute, you know, if I took that, your content, if I took the rights to your content, can I convert it into an audio and video series that I want to put inside with a series of other experts who have created things on marketing and sales and management and things and make you one a part of this CD series or this download series or whatever it is. So suddenly you've got content that could go out in all these different directions. And that's what you can do when you look at it as an intellectual property. So what you really have to do when you create your content is you have to assemble it and say, okay, you know, where can I go with this? What other forms can I do with it? Because if you start to think about it that way, suddenly you'll be surprised at the type of opportunities that you can create to license that content.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any examples that will help us get more concrete on it?
Yeah, I think that there's some great examples. When you look at I guess some of the best examples are some of the motivational speakers that you've seen out there who have been out there speaking, and then they've created audio and video content. What many people don't realize is that a lot of the formats that you see it showing up in are not them producing it directly. They license their speaking, their seminars out to other companies who are then turning around and producing and delivering it in different forms. And you see that from everybody from Tony Robbins to Brian Tracy and any number of companies like that. There are manufacturers out there who deliver audio and video CDs, let's say, directly to retail, to the big retailers. And what they do is they go out and license content. I was actually working with a company, a client that had created just a whole series of seminars, speaking seminars that they did, motivational seminars for small businesses. And they were actually approached by a company that had a program with Walmart. And what they were looking to do is they had secured a kiosk in there. And what they wanted to do is, because mainly what they had saw, the opportunity they saw was that a lot of these programs were typically delivered direct response or online, but nobody was doing anything with, you know, big retailers. And so what they had done is they had gone in and secured a space, if you will, of a kiosk. And what they were doing is they were going out licensing rights to all these experts' content that they could take for sales in physical retail locations like a Walmart. Okay. And that what they were doing then is they would license it in several formats. One, to do it as a standalone, okay, just your content, you, Warren, your content as a CD set featured inside this kiosk. And then the other was as a compilation that they would put together of several expertise content providers inside a special volume, whatever that may be, so that they could create, you know, multi-packs, single packs, the kind of thing that you would see that are done with products, you know, tangible products, let's say. They were doing the same thing with expert content at the retail level.
So compared to what you could make from a traditional publishing deal, the content, the owner of the content could do quite well, the licensee. And also, the person doing that kiosk is cutting out the whole publishing arm of having to go out and, you know, buy my book and stock it in this kiosk, which would probably be a disaster with the kind of margins that he was able to get there. But creating something else, he's got more to work with. So it's everybody wins, other than the old school people that got cut out.
Yeah, you raise a good point. I mean, especially when it comes to this publishing in the book, I mean, the model is changed. It's interesting you talk about publishers. When I was at the studios, publishing was one of the categories that I handled. I used to go out and I work with all the biggies, Scholastic, Random House, Simon Schuster, mm-hmm. you name it. And it's an industry that's really not changed and evolved, especially when it comes to the digital media. And as a consequence of that, what you're seeing is that all this content that typically would go through a publishing house, which controlled the distribution, suddenly is no longer the case, because you can reach out directly to the customer now in many forms. And one of the things that they were looking at, going back to this case in point of this kiosk at something like a Walmart, suddenly what they realized is, wait a minute, you know, this book format that's traditionally been used is a very expensive and cumbersome process. I mean, typically what they would do is they would produce 100,000 books knowing that 50% of them would come back. And that was very expensive. So what's happened is entrepreneurs who realize, wait a minute, that content can be packaged up in other formats beside a book or other products that can be delivered to retail much more efficiently and much more profitably. And that in fact is what's occurring. Is what other ways can this content be delivered or packaged or put into products that can be delivered outside of this traditional model? And that is what's occurring more and more now today. And that's the exciting part. I mean, if you're one of the things that I say, you know, when you've got content, it's always interesting on how you present it. Because another example is I had a client that had a new kids entertainment. It was a brand for obesity, and it represented obesity. And, you know, the cartoon, the essence of the cartoon was always about some story about the kids helping each other to, you know, tackle this obesity. And one of the first things they did, even though they developed it as a book series, the books were actually secondary. We didn't look at it as a book series. We said, well, where can we go with these characters that it makes sense? One of the first things they did is they started doing live events where they created a costume character and went into the schools and used the character as an educational, because kids are you know, a magnet always to this character. And then as a result of that, they created some merchandise with the slogans and the sayings that came right out of the books, like, you know, be slim, don't overeat, all that sort of thing. So what we were doing with it is we were actually taking the book content and figuring out, okay, if we applied it to a live character, if we applied it to merchandise, if we applied it in different ways, could we do some fun things with it? And that's, in fact, what happened. And then it ultimately led to a deal with a very large distributor of educational products into the school system who loved the character, loved what it represented, and agreed to have the character in promotions for school programs that they were doing. And that was kind of the way that we focused on the content, as opposed to the book, where even though they were publishing the book, we knew it was a long haul to get the book sold. And it worked out real well. You know, it started the momentum going, and then it got them engaged with other nonprofit groups who liked what they were doing. And ultimately, they set up a school contest for kids to come and play. We found, actually, interesting story. We found a startup company that had a device. It was hooked to a video monitor. It was like a video game, but it had all these really cool videos that kids would compete against. Like, one was doing these dance moves, the other was jumping or skipping. Okay, and how many beats could you skip as fast as you could in a minute? And so what happened is we actually got together with that company and we branded it with this kid's, you know, property. And basically, they took those products out and were selling them to the schools because they helped promote physical activity for the kids and got them engaged and got them active, and they had fun and they interacted. And then, of course, you know, we took some of the books and we gave them out at these events and things like that. So, again, just a different way of thinking. Where can we go with the content?
Well, I know in my work in publishing, it's, you know, predominantly people are being self-published. And while I had some traditional books, you know, for the most part, we think of the book as just being the loss leader to get started, and doing many of these things. What intrigues me about all this is that in all that I've ever done or talked about or been involved with, I've yet to put anything into a Walmart store. And there's a whole big audience out there of people who, you know, don't know who I am or don't know who my clients are. They could be buying it in a Walmart if somebody had that particular distribution channel. Mm-hmm. Not the first one that comes to mind for what I do, but, you know, I like the thinking on that. How does somebody decide whether or not they need to engage you or go after licensing? How do they assess what the value of their property is?
Yeah, good question. I mean, what you want to do is when you've created, let's talk about your content, you've created your expertise, you've got a body of knowledge that you put into this format of books, and you've been out there either promoting it and selling it, and people have been consuming it, you're probably at a stage where you've got an opportunity to do something more with your content, okay? Mm-hmm. And the trick here then, of course, is you have to kind of step back and think about, okay, what do I have here? Because it's more than your content. I mean, you've created your content, but have you also put a brand around it? Okay, have you been calling it something? Is it just under your name, which you are your brand? Okay, and if not, is there a brand around it? Okay, and so do I have, you know, is the material copyrighted? So you want to make sure you have all that. So you want to be able to start looking and identifying what you have. Then you have to decide, you know, is it something that there's a market for it? And you have to do a little homework for that. You have to decide, you know, where can I go with this? And probably one of the best things to do is take a look at who some of your competitors are and see what kind of products that they've put into the market, similar types of products, see what forms they're in. And you know, that's some homework that can be done very quickly. And if you can see that there's, whether it's CDs, DVDs, T-shirts, hats, whatever it is, then you know that there's a market for it. Then the question is it something that I want to pursue myself, or, you know, would I be better served engaging somebody such as myself, a licensing agent or a licensing consultant, to work with me to get my intellectual property content into licensable form, and then to take it out there and market it and help me to find companies that want to partner with me and take my content into other forms. Sometimes it's best to start off yourself, try to see if you can find one deal initially and get started. And then if you see it's really going to grow, then consider somebody, you know, such as myself. But it really depends on what you want to do. And that's typically the process that you'd want to go through to take your first step, if you will, into the licensing game.
So I imagine there are as many different ways to structure the deal with you as there are everything else. So that could be.
Oh yeah.
We could go on for hours just talking about that. But essentially, what does it cost to hire a licensing agent? And if you decide you can't afford that or not ready to do that, what else do you have?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there's really two types of agents out there. There's one that's called the contingency. They work strictly on a back-end model, and there's others such as myself who work on a monthly compensation plus a little bit of the back-end. So it's a question of who you want to work with. Obviously, if you're working with somebody on contingency, they're carrying a large stable of properties because they never know which one is going to pan out, versus somebody such as myself who's there to work directly with you on a day-to-day basis and build the program and get it out there and manage it and everything else. For those that are not in a position to, either retain a licensing agent, the next best thing I always recommend is to get some good coaching. And what I offer is I've got a new program that's set up called the IP Licensing Academy, and it was set up with my partner, Mitch Axelrod, and it was done specifically so that more people can get involved in getting the right kind of advice and know-how and direction to do their licensing. And for a lot of people, you know, they want to initially come into it, but maybe they don't have quite the resources. This is an ideal format that they can get into. They can get in, they get a package, if you will, an initial package that gives them all of my wisdom and Mitch's wisdom in the form of audio programs in which we share basically the licensing lessons, the licensing information, what it is, how it works, what to do, when to do it. And then we combine that with a monthly coaching that gives you, the members, an opportunity to come in and say, okay, here's my IP, I've been listening to it, I'm at this stage and ready to go, what do I do next? I'm at this stage, I'm ready to go, what do I do next? And then give you an opportunity on a 30-day cycle to get out there and make it happen, because I can tell you that 80% of the success in licensing your IP is getting out there and doing something. Okay, many people don't realize, but 95% of all intellectual property is never commercialized, is never licensed. Okay. And the reason is predominantly because people fail to take action. I'm talking about both individuals, content creators, all the way up to big multinational global corporations who have tons and tons of IP, and they never take action on it. They never commercialize it. And there's a whole bunch of reasons and opportunities in there, which I can discuss at another time. But that's one of the biggest factors of success, is taking action with it. And you've got to be able to do that. And so I created the IP License Academy because nobody's out there teaching you this process, this skill set, if you will, of how do I make money with my IP. And so that's where, for somebody who wants to get involved, wants to get started, I would highly recommend getting into the IP Licensing Academy, because we created it in such a format that it makes it easy for people to get into it, whatever stage you're in, and be able to get the momentum going, get moving, get comfortable, get the vernacular, get the skill set out there so you can start making it happen.
Right. Yeah, and I haven't reviewed or can endorse what you're saying, but, I mean, just obvious common sense tells me that if I'm going to consider going and listing my product on something like it sounded almost like a directory of these contingency people, you can give up rights and really get yourself into trouble where you can't do anything else. Makes sense to go and invest a little bit of time understanding it, and then ultimately, if you have the funds or it's a big enough project, you make sure you hire somebody to do it for you.
Yeah, I would say that. And you raised a good point, and I'll make this final comment here. You said about getting a little educated. I'd say probably one of the biggest challenges for a lot of people is if they go into the market and they start this process and they get involved in a deal and they don't know what they're doing and they sign the wrong document. That's where the problems come in, and that's where, you know, getting the advice, whether it's through direct consulting or through a membership program like I've talked about, can save you a lot of time and aggravation and ultimately make you much more successful on the back end.
So only one more thing we need to wrap this up. How do we contact you?
Okay. Well, there's a couple of ways you can contact me. You can email me directly at rand@licensingforprofits.com. Okay. rand@licensingforprofits, profits.com. You can also visit one of two websites, either licensingconsultinggroup.com, or you can go to licensingforprofits.com. And let me just throw in here for any listener who's interested, I also encourage you to go visit the IP Licensing Academy. That's iplicensingacademy.com. And between those three, you're going to get a lot of great information. You'll be able to get a hold of me. You'll be able to get yourself some foundation on licensing. And I'd love to hear from any of your listeners who are interested or like more information about, you know, how they can go out and make some money with their intellectual property.
Great. This has been great. I'm thinking about other ideas and half done projects. and it's
that's
true.
What I like to hear
95% because you know it's there's stuff sitting on my computer drive. It's been fascinating, Rand. Thanks so much. And I'm sure someone's going to be following up and looking at this stuff. And we'll see you all next time on the Warren Whitlock Show. Bye.
Thanks a lot, Warren. Bye-bye.
Amiga, te tengo tremendo cuento. If you switch to AT&T, you can get $300 in credits when you buy a Samsung Note 5 on AT&T Next and trade in a smartphone.
Wow. Why are you whispering so much? What are you talking about?
Great news. Switch to AT&T and get $300 in credits.
What?
Oh, Norma, did you hear? $300 in credits when you switch to AT&T.
Switch to AT&T and get $300 in credits when you buy a Samsung Note 5 on AT&T Next and trade in a smartphone. AT&T, mobilizing your world. Limited time offers. Requires port-in eligible service and trade-in. Get $100 bill credit applied within 90 days and $200 trade-in credit, which may be a promotion card. Fees, other charges, and restrictions apply. See store or att.com/summerbuyback for details.